learning lecture on a difficult subject, and that of Jean-Paul Sartre. I have been told by your instructor you're in the midst of studying existentialism. That's my own conviction that you can do no better if you're going to study existentialist philosophy than to study the philosophy of Sartre, because he is the existentialist par excellence. Of course, Sartre is a timely subject for us as well, seeing as that he passed away just last week. Sartre was born in 1905, died in 1980, and so has lived about three quarters of a century and has really made his mark in that time. Sartre was born into a bourgeois family in France. His father was a naval officer who, when Sartre was only 2 years old, died. And so he was brought up in the house of his grandfather, who, it turns out, was a linguistics professor and a person who paid a great deal of attention to him. His Roman Catholic mother, he says, he loved, but he did not understand. And he found that because of the Lutheran background of most of his family and the hostility that was shown toward his mother, that he was very early sickened at the idea of religion. He studied philosophy eventually, and when he was a student of philosophy, he met someone who would become his lifelong mistress, Simone de Beauvoir. The war brought him during the war, time of the war, he spent his time as a secondary school teacher, and in 1940 he became a weather clerk for the army at the front in France, but he was eventually captured by the Germans, and after 6 months was able to escape by passing himself off as a rather sickly and weak-eyed civilian who would not be of any military service to the French. And so he went back to Paris and then waited out the Nazi occupation of Paris. During this time, he wrote one of his best-known plays, The Flies, that was brought out in 1943. And when it was performed in France, the Germans eventually shut it down because the strong emphasis upon freedom, the idea that any crime is justifiable if it's made, the decision to commit that crime is made as an authentic act, was naturally a threat to the Germans, because it only encouraged the French to resist what they were accomplishing in France themselves. In the course of his life, Sartre expounded his ideas in 9 plays, 4 novels, 5 major philosophical works, and then, of course, innumerable lectures and essays. He managed to become an influential philosopher at a time in history, in Western history, when philosophers, I think it's fair to say, had pretty much ceased to influence almost anybody. Philosophy had become something of a relic by the end of the Second World War and at a time when culture, because of the devastation of the Nazis and Adolf Hitler, was looking for guidance, and when most values seemed questionable, when most human ideals were suspect, the post-war generation found a great deal of solace in the austere arms of the existentialism of Sartre. Now, Sartre's prose brings abstract ideas down to the level of demands for action made upon the individual. And because Sartre was a committed atheist, because he felt God did not exist, it was essential that man define for himself what his own essence would be. And in a rather ironic way, Sartre's philosophy gave a moral dimension to what would be an indifferent universe, given his atheistic perspective on life. He gave a moral dimension to the universe because he said that a man cannot blame what he is or has become on his circumstances, on his family, on his past, on God, or anything else. Men decide what they shall be. Their fate is in their own hands, and therefore they must take responsibility for what has happened to them. In the attempt to avoid that responsibility, he called bad faith. We'll be talking about that a little bit later. During his lifetime, Sartre led demonstrations, was very active in making protests, very active in political demonstrations. He was at many number of political barricades in France throughout his life. just about any cause of the political left. Because of the hatred of the corruption of the bourgeois class in France, Sartre was naturally drawn to communism, and in the course of his life very often wrote what are considered by most people labored excuses for Soviet faux pas, Soviet atrocities, the purges, the Liberian labor camps, the invasions. In 1964, Sartre was offered the Nobel Prize but refused it because he said he refused to become a pawn in the political and cultural struggle between the East and the West. And toward the end of his life, he appears to have taken solace from the Maoist line of communism, and because the Maoists professed, anyway, to take their leadership from the masses. Sartre felt that he found in them the purest example of revolutionaries close to his own heart. Throughout his life, he was not in robust health. He was blind in his right eye at the age of 3 and lost almost all vision in his remaining good eye in 1973 after a heart attack. In fact, one of his most, it seems to me, difficult works and perhaps most important works, a biography of Gustave Flaubert, had to be given up at that point. He had worked on it for 16 years but could not continue. His mistress, Simone de Beauvoir, continued to nurse him in his last years. He was secluded in the last couple of years, entered the hospital a number of times for pulmonary disease, and as you know, died last week. Well, enough of historical and background to Sartre. My interest today really is in the existentialist philosophy that he portrayed and his influence on various realms of academic and intellectual life. Sartre is an intellectual in the French tradition of the Enlightenment. Perhaps he can be called the most prodigious son of autonomous rationalism. In Sartre, we see rationalism come to its dead end. His destructive genius is, in fact, generic, cutting across the divisions of nationality, tradition, and any number of fields of study. For Sartre was at once a philosopher, a psychologist, a critic, a playwright, a novelist, and a political theorist, even though philosophy turned out to be his central and organizing principle. And the influence of Sartre, it's fair to say, has washed up on the shores of ethics, politics, philosophy, 3 or 4 literary genres in our century, and I don't believe that his influence is likely to ebb soon. Sartre was convinced that religion is morally evil, and he saw in the idea of God in Western theistic tradition a notion that was self-contradictory. And so Sartre is known for expanding and adapting the philosophic views of Martin Heidegger and for being influenced primarily by Edmund Husserl while remaining nevertheless a philosopher in his own right. Almost all existentialist literature in our day stems from the Sartrean branch, although there are other fields of existentialist literature, and I think it's also fair to say that Sartre has masterfully presented that branch of existentialist literature in his own works. He appeared before the public in 1938 with the publication of his book, Nausea. It was at a time when the public was more interested on a whole with ideological rather than literary problems, and Sartre refreshingly cleared the ground for a more realistic approach to the impending problems facing both the individual and the world in Western Europe. His originality and appeal is accounted for by, I think, his ability to etch a disturbing intellectual realism upon our minds while uncompromisingly rejecting all previous approaches to the human dilemma. His stress in writing was away from history, away from narrative, away from events, unlike Tolstoy, who always asked in his novels, what really happened here? Sartre's influence was away from that and upon the literary act itself, the very act of writing. And this he emphasized and gave importance to it in writing his book, What is Literature?, one of the landmarks in the literary approach of commitment in the 20th century. The secret of Sartre's influence lies in his literary and polemical works. It's not surprising that this should be so, for while philosophy is the central principle of Sartre, as Sartre has said, quote, metaphysics is not a barren discussion of abstract notions which escape experience, but a living effort to embrace the whole of the human condition from inside, end of quote. That Sartre is significant as a literary figure is further implied in the fact that his technique has been more effective, I think, than his ideas have been. At least most philosophers would testify to that, I believe. Sartre is well known for a fertile imagination, concrete and suggestive formulation of abstract ideas, hallucinatory imagery in his writings, the ability to evoke unpleasant physical sensations in what he says, the ability to convey the arbitrary and quite non-selective quality of our immediate experiences. That may in fact stem from the influence of Husserl and phenomenology on him. As a literary figure, Sartre's views waylaid the surrealist who compromised the marching wing, or comprised the marching wing of literature in the early 1930s. Sartre's literature is significant precisely because it is philosophical literature, and his philosophy cannot be adequately understood without corresponding appreciation for what he has accomplished in his novels and plays. All right. In harmony with existentialist method, the existentialist contribution to literature should not be approached with the question, what happened in the literature, but rather, how did it happen? The concern is with internal, individualized, personal happenings of man as man, and not with external events as such. Plot, if you want to put it very simply, becomes subservient to characterization in Sartre's writing. Sartre is at his best in depicting the agonies of an alienated man, the sufferings of a hero crucified by metaphysical doubts about himself and the reality he cannot resolve. The existentialist hero, if we can speak of there being such a thing, the existentialist hero has no duties, he has no loyalties, and he has no rights. And so his recurring question is, what am I? Consequently, the protagonist in existentialist literature is characterized by an indulgence and introspection. He produces soliloquies probing harder and harder beyond anything imagined by Shakespearean characters. The existentialist hero is continually spying on himself in a metaphysically incoherent and desperate manner. Each fortuitous digression of thought is painfully observed and reflectively attacked. And yet the feeling of purposelessness which attaches to this introspection is built right into the account of the character. The existentialist hero is concerned not with the plot structure, but with the state of his own being, the state of his own thoughts and moods, his doubts and dilemmas, his psychic milieus, and his incapacity to act. He is, if you will, Hamlet. In portraying man as choosing what he is struggling to become, Sartre nearly dissolves the dimensions of human personality in many of his works. The protagonist suffers because he knows not what he is and has no guidelines by which to choose. And so mutability becomes painted across the Sartrean universe. In plot and characterization, the protagonist gets hemmed into an everlasting hell of his own device, and he's never to be reprieved. Sartre does not look for a universal man in his writings. His philosophy does not permit him that kind of enterprise. In his fiction, Sartre studies rather the personalized, concrete, irrational, and problematic individual. If the existentialist hero is to be authentic and radically free, then what transpires in and around him cannot be the experience of some abstracted and universal man. It is almost as if Sartre could not have made the same point if he were to shift the scene and the character. Every situation is a unique situation in existentialist thought, and this fact will become highly significant in existentialist ethics. In Sartre's novels, the hero insists that he must remain uncompromisingly loyal to himself alone. But since he never knows the nature of his own self, he is always at a loss as to how to act. Freedom is his craving, freedom is his vice, and for Sartre, freedom becomes his madness. And so instead of assuming responsibility, which is one of the key concerns in existentialist ethics, instead of assuming responsibility and plunging into the life of action, the protagonist engages in interminable introspection and self-analysis. Contemporary existentialism, both philosophical and literary, then, is fundamentally ethical in its origin and motivation. It explores man's status in the universe and the implications it has for man's behavior in particular. Sartre extols the virtues of authenticity and legitimate anguish, while disdaining the life of bad faith or self-deception, any attempt to escape from one's freedom and responsibility. An analysis of the human situation reveals both appropriate and reprehensible kinds of behavior
and response to that universal human condition of freedom. And thus ethical concern is heightened in existentialism. Sartre affirms that, quote, the subject of literature has always been man in the world, end of quote, and that true literature is being calling out to man. And here he's using conspicuously the language of Heidegger, original being calling out to man in his projects in the world. Here the stress of the character himself and his behavior is sufficiently clear. For all his rejection of absolutes, Sartre is quite obviously interested in authentic being and legitimate action. This is what his philosophy is all about. However, having said that, Sartre's literary characters are crippled regarding their action. They continue to struggle with existential dictates, being obsessed with the radical freedom Sartre says they have. The discontinuity of reality, the despair of the characters, and the necessity to act are all reflected in Sartre's style of writing as well. If you in your literary classes are looking for a figure who reflects his philosophy and the very style of his writing, I would recommend that of any that you can choose, Sartre would have to be high on the list. This, I think, perhaps explains his uncanny realism and his ability to entangle us in his plots as readers. One of the aspects of Sartrean literature is that of a committed approach. And that aspect is just as integral, appropriate, and related to Sartre's existentialism as are his emphases in his literature on individualized character and free behavior. According to Sartre, commitment is inherent in the act of writing. For to write is to talk, and to talk is to reveal an aspect of the world in order to change it. And so in his book, What is Literature?, he maintains that writing is a social act resting on the will to communicate and resolve to change the world. He says, quote, the aim of literature is to communicate, to impart to others the results one has obtained. As I talk, I reveal the situation. I reveal it to myself and others in order to change it, end of quote. Sartre the point here is simply that anything that does not lead to activity, does not lead to some kind of committed action, is worthless, it's dead, it's indifferent to Sartre. Sartre maintains at times, a writer must speak to an imaginary public which he hopes will exist someday. And so literature has a concealed utopian character, it seems. This is more than just a bit ironic, I think, considering the fact that Sartre's literature shows us man reaching his ideal in realistically acknowledging the absurdity of all existence and the anguish which attaches to its to reality. Nevertheless, life is not to be construed as a dead mechanism, according to Sartre, and that's his basis for rejecting a naturalistic novel. The determinism of naturalistic writing destroys character, says Sartre. And so Sartre rejects Taine's theory of the milieu as producing the writer and conditioning his themes, styles, and development. Sartre is an avid believer, I'm getting at over and over again, in free will. He's more than avid in his belief, he's absolutely radical in his belief in free will. At first, the universe might seem dreary because of the material universe is not interested in man's fate, and man is alone in the space-time continuum with no one to turn to. And yet, this is glorious, according to Sartre, because man is then free. He's dependent only on his own volition, and he's beyond good and evil. At the heart of writing, then, Sartre discerns the moral imperative, for literature is a means of enabling men to confront their own freedom. Literary creation is an existentialist gamble, a shaping of the future. Sartre says that the men of this age are confronted with the task of creating, quote, a literature which unites and reconciles the metaphysical absolute and the relativity of the historical fact, end of quote. And so Sartre employs the art of suggestion, the art of implied doubt, intending to infect his readers with a feeling that their versions of the story are only one among many. The reader is not allowed the advantage of impartial viewing from outside the story, where a distinct subject-object dichotomy can safeguard his traditional blindness or his false securities. Nor is the reader given a guiding hand from within Sartre's stories, as if it were merely a situation introduced by an all-knowing viewer which of course Sartre's atheism would preclude as a writer. And so Sartre says, since we were situated, the only novels we could dream of were novels of situation, without internal narrators or all-knowing witnesses. We had to make the technique of the novel shift from Newtonian mechanics to generalized relativity. We had to present creatures whose reality would be the tangled and contradictory tissue of each one's evaluation of all the other characters, himself included, and the evaluations by all the others of himself, and who could never decide from within whether the changes of their destinies came from their own efforts, from their own faults, or from the course of the universe. End of quote. Hence, useless chronological narration is abandoned by Sartre, giving way to historical relativism that can make the present come alive through the stress of utter subjectivity. Sartre developed a literature then which proclaims its unyielding message in the very form in which he presents it. His very theory of art, the style of his writing, and his philosophy are one. And in that, I cannot praise Sartre enough. It is rare for a philosopher to have that kind of consistency. Published in 1963, well, excuse me, it turned out, I need to say before I go on to this, that Sartre's literary theory was ineffective, however, and it proved as unworkable, as we'll see in a minute, his philosophy is unworkable. And Sartre seems to have realized this, for in 1963, he published the closest thing to an autobiography that we have for him, entitled The Words, a very significant title, given the influence of his literary theory and the importance of his literature for his philosophy. The Words reveals his bitter skepticism concerning the all-powerful character of words and the ironic onslaught against the mandate of literature as he had once seen it. The book indicates that although he had given up the Father and the Son of Christian theology, using his language, the Holy Spirit managed to keep a grip on him for a while and to inspire him with false ideas about a special priesthood of literature. And so he coldly asserts in the book, I have changed. I collared the Holy Spirit in the cellar and threw him out. Atheism is a cruel and long-range affair. I think I've carried it through. I've given up the office, but not the frock. I still write. What else can I do? It's a habit, and besides, it's my profession. For a long time, I took my pen for a sword. I know now we're powerless. No matter. I write and will keep writing books. They're needed all the same. They do serve some purpose. Culture doesn't save anything or anyone. It doesn't justify. But it's the product of man. He projects himself into it. He recognizes himself in it. That critical mirror alone offers him his image. I think in this quotation, the despair, the man-centeredness, and the incorrigible activistic emphasis of existentialism is abundantly manifest. Sartre has purified his approach to literature now, and purified it of its illusions in order that he might not hide behind the pen and fail to engage effectively in existentialist action in an absurd world. Very simply, what I'm saying is Sartre realized that his whole view of the purposefulness of writing was contrary to his existentialist view of reality. Taking stark appraisal of history and culture, Sartre concluded that in a world where hunger prevails, most of Western art and literature is a waste of time. For, as he said, his book Nausea, perhaps his best known work, his book Nausea cannot act as a counterweight against a dying child. If one conclusion flows from all this, it is that Sartre's life, his literature, his theory, and his philosophical outlook are dynamically and vitally intertwined and infused with a serious import that beckons that we not overlook it. A world in life view has received uncanny extension in the work of Sartre, along with an indirect and often honest recognition of its inadequacy. Okay, with that background to the life and now the literary work and what I think are some of the commendable features of Sartrean writing, I'd like to become a little more philosophical and talk about some of his key concepts and then eventually become a little critical of them. The doctrine of nothingness, the doctrine of negation, is crucial to Sartrean existentialism, especially his account of freedom. Sartre, you see, feels that the very posing of the ontological question immediately leads to confrontation with nothingness. And so in Being and Nothingness, he says, what being will be must of necessity arise on the basis of what is not. Whatever being is, it will allow this formulation. Being is that, and outside that, nothing. Thus, a new component of the real has just appeared to us, non-being. Okay, Sartre says, you make an effort to describe or to analyze or to define being. It will turn out that if you say being is, okay, whatever, being is that, then necessarily being is not whatever is outside of whatever you've used to describe being or whatever concept you've used for the sake of analyzing being. And so being is that and nothing else. Consequently, you cannot define being without some realm of non-being over against which you know what being is. Okay. Let's take another step in existentialist philosophy. Truth must be not being. We have being and not being. And truth must be over here with not being. Why is that? Well, this is for two reasons. Truth is always about being, says Sartre, and therefore distinguishable from it. Okay, if truth is always about being, thereby being distinguishable from it, truth must be not being. Moreover, truth always involves distinction and limitation. If I say that this is a cloudy day, then I'm drawing some kind of a distinction. It's cloudy over against sunny. I'm speaking of this day over against the whole week. I'm speaking about our locality over against some other part of the United States. Truth always involves distinction and limitation. But being itself is a plenum. Being itself is the undivided parmenidean one. And since truth involves distinctions, and being is one undifferentiated whole, truth cannot be being. Okay, so for both these reasons, truth is not being rather than being itself. Now, the origin of nothingness presents a paradox, Sartre thinks. For being cannot give rise to non-being. Being cannot give rise to non-being, and sheer nothingness is not. Thus, it has no power to annihilate being in order to create non-being. Consequently, a third thing besides being and nothing is required in Sartrean metaphysics. Okay? We have being, we have nothing, and a third thing must be introduced to account for the origin of nothing. A being which can produce nothingness. By the way, I realize that when you go over this quickly, a lot of this can just sound like a bunch of verbal, shuffling of the cards. But that, while I'm going to criticize it for equivocation in due time, Sartre is trying to make sense here. He's just not, playing pseudo-sophisticated in this kind of language. All that he says has an initial plausibility about it. Truth is not being because truth is about being, so it's over here. Being introduces very naturally, by any definition of it, the realm of not being over against which it's defined. Okay? But where does nothing come from then? Where does not being come from? It can't come from being. That would be contradictory. Being doesn't give rise to not being, to nothing. And nothing doesn't have any power in itself to annihilate being and become nothing. So where does nothing come from? Sartre is quite concerned with that. The nothingness must be within itself and non-derived, from whence would something derive it. Therefore, he says, quote, the being by which nothingness comes to the world must be its own nothingness. Sounds paradoxical. The being by which nothingness comes to the world must be its own nothingness. The being that gives rise to nothing must be its own nothingness. It must be being and nothingness at the same time. This being, which is its own nothingness, is consciousness. Okay? The third thing is consciousness. And consciousness in Sartre is the same as human reality. So if you will, that being, which is also nothingness, is human consciousness. Human consciousness. In order to be this, man must have, correct that, man must rather be freedom. Man must be freedom. Sartre's theory of freedom is foundational for his ethics. He identifies freedom with human reality. Man is constituted by and is freedom. And so in his novel, The Age of Reason, which is the first installment of Sartre's trilogy, his well-known trilogy, this is what we read on the last page. Matthew thought, "I remain alone. Alone, but no freer than before. No one has interfered with my freedom. My life has drained it dry. Much ado about nothing," he thought, "for nothing." This life had been given him for nothing. He was nothing, and yet he would not change. When we come to The Reprieve, the second novel in the trilogy, Matthew is a soldier in the war, realizing that his life lies wasted behind him with no hope of being reprieved. He comes to recognize that his difficulties reside solely with himself, but now the war had swooped down and crushed his future to nothing. The question pressing upon him is, what is this self to which he has so obstinately clung? And the answer is nothing. He comes to perceive that the freedom he had sought was to be found within himself. And so he mutters, quote, "I am my own freedom." This means that man must be distant from the world as being in itself and be able to detach himself from it. Consciousness or human reality, man being his own freedom, means he has to be able to distance himself from being in itself, that which has existence, being in itself. He must be able to distance himself from it. And so in the novel Nausea, Antoine Roquentin is approximating just that detachment when he stands back and observes, quote, "And then all of a sudden, there it was, clear as day, existence had suddenly unveiled itself. It had the lost, harmless look of an abstract category. It was the very paste of things. This veneer had melted, leaving soft, monstrous masses, all in disorder, naked in a frightful, obscene nakedness." There's existence. He has distanced himself from being itself. Now, this is clever. The ability to other the world, the ability to negate the world, is freedom. Okay, freedom becomes the ability to negate the world. Man, who is the source of distinction and limitation, man is the source of truth. I have drawn the distinction. Today is a cloudy day. I've limited, I've categorized. Man, who is the source of distinction and limitation, could not then be this being in itself. Since man draws distinctions within being, he cannot be being in itself. Man, unlike the beings in themselves, which have no aspirations, and thus can be completely characterized in general laws, like rocks and trees and automobiles and sicknesses and all the rest, man, who is unlike beings in themselves, which have no aspirations and thus can be completely characterized in general laws, is a self-conscious creature who has the ability to project things, to think of things in a negative way. Today's a cloudy day, but I can project that it's a sunny day. I can imagine that it's a sunny day in the middle of summer, and we're going to the park. I can pretend that I'm not now lecturing, but I'm really somewhere else. I'm swimming at the lake. Man has this ability to project, to conceive a situation negatively, and to express emotion. And this inherent intentionality of man constitutes his freedom for Sartre. Okay? This shows us Sartre's tendency to group all human projects from perception to deliberation together under the genus of intended doing. All that we are is a doing because we are our freedom. Human reality has the ability to negate the world, to imagine things other than they really are, to think contrary to what being in itself is, or to divide being in itself into categories and to limit it when it's described. Now the point is that man's conscious ability to project negative states of affairs, contrary to the way things presently are, is his freedom. Thus he is absolutely set off from being in itself. Man is a lacking, Sartre says. He is nothing. He is a whole in being. And so consciousness becomes the human consciousness or the human reality is the source of nothing, because we negate the world, we negate being in itself, and thereby create nothingness. We create not being, that which is contrary to the way things really are. And I think perhaps the clearest capsule summary to be found of Sartre's philosophy is found in Being and Nothingness, pages 439 and 40. And I'm going to read what amounts to a fairly long paragraph. He says, human reality is its own nothingness. For the for itself, now that's a term I haven't introduced yet, consciousness, human reality, freedom, this ability to negate the world, all amounts to being for itself. For itself, because we are always acting in terms of our intentionalities, in terms of our projections, in terms of our own plans, in terms of our own decisions. We are being for itself. The trash can over here, the tree outside, is only being in itself. It has no intentionality, no freedom, no action in behalf of its own well-being. Is not defining itself or making its own essence. Now, human reality is its own nothingness. For itself to be is to annihilate the in itself which it is. Under these conditions, freedom can be nothing other than this annihilation. It is through this that the for itself escapes its being as its essence. It is through this that the for itself is always something other than what can be said of it. For in the final analysis, the for itself is the one which escapes this denomination. The one which is already beyond the name which is given to it, beyond the property which is recognized in it. To say that the for itself has to be what it is, to say that it is what it is not, to say that in it existence precedes and conditions essence, all this is to say one and the same thing, to be aware that man is free. I am condemned to exist forever beyond my essence, beyond the causes and motives of my acts. I am condemned to be free. This means that no limits to my freedom can be found except freedom itself, or if you prefer, that we are not free to cease being free. Freedom is in its foundation coincides with the nothingness which is at the heart of man. Human reality is free because it is not enough. That's beautiful French writing, by the way, but it's a rather clever philosophical outlook. You see how all these things get combined now. We are free just because we negate the world as human reality. We are being for itself. Freedom is therefore logically contingent upon the fact that man is nothingness. The for itself is nothing but the pure annihilation of the in itself. That is, the ability to project negatively against the state of in itself affairs. Such annihilation or nothingness is man's freedom. And I'm going to say in a few minutes that Sartre is in fact equivocating on all of this, and so it's not very good philosophy, but that is what he is trying to get at. Now, Sartre offers a more concrete account of human freedom when he indicates that we have freedom from certain things. He says in his book, we have freedom from our passions because we freely choose to give in to them or resist them. And since the consciousness is nothing, the passions can have no purchase upon our consciousness. So we are free from passions. He says we are free from our motives. in the psychological sense, because there exists no centrum, no ego which the motive could adhere to. And in the sense of rational deliberation, we are free from our motives because before deliberating, we have already decided what sorts of reasons we will allow to have weight in our thinking. So choice and the consciousness are finally the same thing. He says, you think that you're going to deliberate? You've already decided what you're going to deliberate upon and what conditions under which you'll deliberate and what the standards are going to be. And so, in fact, your consciousness and your choice are the same. Thirdly, he says, we are free from the in itself that is just dead being. We are free from this since it can only affect being, and the for itself, which is not being, lies outside the causal series. The for itself cannot be affected in that way. And so we are not being in itself. And finally, Sartre says, we are free from our essence because existence precedes and formulates essence. And here's where we come to the well-known quotation from his best essay, I think, Existentialism as a Humanism. What is meant by saying that existence precedes essence? It means that first of all, man exists, turns up, appears on the scene, and only afterwards defines himself. If man, as the existentialist conceives him, is indefinable, it is because at first he is nothing. Only afterward will he be something, and he himself will have made what he will be. Thus, there is no human nature, since there is no God to conceive it. Not only is man what he conceives himself to be, but he is also only what he wills himself to be after this thrust toward existence. Man is nothing else but what he makes of himself. Such is the first principle of existentialism. So man's choice is a free agent. Man's choice as nothingness defines himself as he goes along. Man is nothing. By freely choosing certain things, he is now making an essence for himself. He was nothing, he becomes his own essence. Man is always free to choose any new essence. Man has no nature or defining characteristics prior to his existence as a choosing being who decides what he will be. So then it follows that man is also free from antecedently fixed values, and he defines his values as he chooses them. And so in his essay, Sartre says, the existentialist thinks it's very distressing that God does not exist, because all possibility of finding values in a heaven of ideas disappears along with him. Dostoevsky said, if God didn't exist, everything would be possible. This is the very starting point of existentialism, and as a result, man is forlorn, because neither within himself nor without does he find anything to cling to. Therefore, every choice is justifiable as well as absurd for Sartre, since it can have no rational and sufficient justification. The very standards in terms of which a choice could be justified are always logically posterior to the choice. There are then not good choices and bad choices, just choices. The crux of Sartre's ethical doctrine lies in this view that human reality is not bound by any system of pre-established values and has absolute freedom with respect to all values. This constitutes the most radical doctrine of human freedom formulated, as far as I know, in the history of Western philosophy. Matthew, a philosophy teacher at the Lycee in the Age of Reason, insists, I am because I will. But the protagonist of the flies is the epitome of Sartre's self-determining man. Orestes, the instrument of fate, is destined to overthrow the gods and determined to avenge his father's death. Orestes is dangerous because he realizes that he is free, and the thesis of Sartre's play is that such a man can shape his own destiny. Orestes believes that by virtue of his discovery of true freedom and his power over even Zeus, that he is the savior of mankind. Justice is man-made, as Orestes sees it, and so he feels no remorse in killing the king and his father's murderer. He declares that the fatal blunder of Zeus was to make him free, because that deed can now not be undone. Two revealing quotes from Orestes. He says, quote, I am my freedom. And secondly, I am doomed to have no other law but mine. We turn to another of Sartre's play. secondly, I am doomed to have no other law but mine. We turn to another of Sartre's plays, No Exit. In it, Sartre portrays life and action as inseparable by envisioning three people in hell in a room where they must forever endure each other's company. That really fine line comes from this play. He says, quote, "There's no need for red-hot pokers. Hell is other people." Even there, the protagonist, Garson, insists that a man is what he wills himself to be. Later, we read in Sartre's play, Dirty Hands, "As for men, it's not what they are that interests me, but what they become." Or in the novel, The Reprieve, the characters are faced with the question, if man is what he chooses, how shall he reckon with the outbreak of war? What is to be made of the accident, the chance, the luck, the external forces which are beyond our control, Sartre? Sartre's response, which seems to be equivocating, is that, quote, "All men collaborate in the act of making war, each constructing its destiny on its own responsibility," end of quote. Man is declared, you see, to be responsible for everything that happens to him, even the inexplicable. Even the outbreak of war that I had no choice in is, in fact, my responsibility. An obvious example of Sartre's doctrine that values do not exist, since God does not exist, is recorded in his work, The Devil and the Good Lord, his most overtly religious work. He says, quote, "On this earth and at this time, good and evil are inseparable. I am willing to be evil in order to become good. God does not exist. No more heaven, no more hell. The earth alone remains. Away with monsters, away with saints, away with pride. There is nothing but men." You could hardly ask for a better existentialist declaration. That man is ethically autonomous permeates, then, the literature of Sartre. In the age of reason, Matthew reflects that, quote, "He could do what he liked. No one had the right to advise him. There would be for him no good nor evil unless he brought them into being," end of quote. And yet, you see, there's something immediately troublesome about this doctrine of absolute freedom as it's expounded in Sartre's works. Matthew grimly ponders in The Age of Reason, "I am free, free in every way, condemned to be free." And Sartre records these words in The Reprieve. Halfway across the Pont Neuf, he stopped and began to laugh. "Liberty! I sought it far away. It was so near that I couldn't touch it. It was, in fact, myself. I am my own freedom." And in the climax of the trilogy, Troubled Sleep, Matthew comes to demonstrate his freedom in a very melodramatic way. He refuses to allow himself to be captured by the advancing Germans, and so desperately fires upon them, giving each shot the value of a symbol. Quote, "It was an enormous revenge. Each shot avenged him for an old scruple. He fired. He was pure. He was all-powerful. He was free." In the moment of being overcome, you see, Sartre says he was free. What is initially disturbing about Sartre's radicalized freedom is that, obviously, many things do impede certain of my choices. I cannot fly of my own ability. I cannot walk through walls, and any number of examples might be given. Sartre labels the whole realm of factors which seem to limit freedom the realm of facticity. Now, this includes five things, Sartre says, the realm of facticity: my place, my past, my surroundings, my fellow men, and my death. Yet Sartre is not willing to consider even these things obstacles to freedom, because he says an obstacle is always an obstacle for someone, constituted by the fact that a goal has been chosen with which that obstacle is incompatible. So freedom itself chooses its obstacles, and they cannot be considered limitations on my freedom. Not only this, but we must distinguish between freedom of choice and freedom of achievement, continues the argument of Sartre. Sartre wishes only to maintain the autonomy of choice. I'm free to choose other goals where these obstacles will not be in my way, and therefore those obstacles, if there are obstacles at all, have got to have become obstacles by my choice. Therefore, I'm even free over my obstacles. Clever, isn't it? The implications of this doctrine of absolute freedom in the realm of morality and ethics are found in Sartre's doctrines of responsibility and anguish. Sartre maintains that absolute freedom implies absolute responsibility. The full responsibility of his existence rests on him, Sartre writes. But it goes much further than this as well, for the autonomous man is also responsible for all mankind. In existentialism, he writes, there is not a single one of our acts which does not at the same time create an image of man as we think he ought to be. Every acting man is to ask himself, according to Sartre, am I really the kind of man who has the right to act in such a way that humanity might guide itself by my actions? In a sense, we confront here Kant's categorical imperative. Man is responsible for bringing truth into the world, and he does this by giving the world whatever characteristics and structure it has. Yet this is done as a free individual. Sartre is not Kantian at this point. The structure which is placed on the in itself by the for itself, the structure put on the world by our free choices, does not flow from inner necessity or any nature of reason. The choosing man could have chosen a different structure, a different truth, a different morality for his world. What is important is that he choose freely and thereby be a responsible example to others. You might want to ponder the inherent contradiction in that, that he must choose freely but as a responsible example. Sartre is saying that we are obligated to act in an unobligated fashion. That is, you must so freely choose the world as you would have it that you are an example to others of that freedom. You are obligated to act in an unobligated way. Now, the result of this fearful responsibility is anguish. Man is alone, says Sartre, and he must choose without guidance. He is also anguished because there is not a bit of assurance that in the future he will not choose another essence and thereby cease to be this man that he's chosen to be. And anguish cannot be gotten rid of, according to Sartre. For in order to conceal anguish from ourselves, we must already know it. And this gets him into the area of self-deception. The dreadful result of anguish is that it incapacitates man to act. He gets trapped in a reflective hell where he can only brood and ponder. Reflective thinking becomes a stumbling block then to his authenticity as an acting man. This is undoubtedly the most characteristic thing about the literature of Sartre, his portrayal of moral paralysis and reflective agony. In The Reprieve, Matthew contemplates the fact that the coming war has completely isolated him from his past. I am free, he said suddenly, and his joy changed on the spot to a crushing sense of anguish. And it is actually through this anguish that our freedom is revealed to us. In The Age of Reason, Matthew goes through a spiritual masochism where he is unable to forget himself. Yet he cannot decide what he is, what he believes in, or what he lives for. Quote, he always felt as though he were somewhere else, that he was not yet fully born. Having no good reasons to act in any way, and refusing to act from impulse, Matthew loses all sense of reality, and then concludes in the very last line of this novel, it's true, it's really true, I have attained the age of reason. Matthew was adrift in a sea of abstractions, where, quote, nothing now seems to be altogether true, end of quote. And so he remained tragically fixed in irresolution, unlike the activist communist, his friend Burnett. He saw himself exposed, and as he was, thoughts about thoughts of thoughts, end of quote. This is precisely the dilemma of Roque and Twine in Nausea. My thought is me. That's why I can't stop. I exist because I think, and I can't stop from thinking. At this very moment, it's frightful. If I exist, it's because I'm horrified at existing. It dawns upon him that the world is radically contingent and cannot be accounted for on any rational basis. Every existing thing, quote, every existing thing is born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and then dies by chance, end of quote. Yet it has a sticky and unavoidable existence as in itself. The anguishing result is a sickening feeling of nausea. Quote, the nausea has given me a short breathing spell, but I know that it will come back again. It is my normal state. Matthew comes to as repulsing a conclusion in Troubled Sleep when he says, here and now I have decided that all along death has been the secret of my life, that I have lived for the purpose of dying. I die in order to demonstrate the impossibility of living. Sartre's comment then is on the nose, isn't it? For him, quote, liberty is terror. Yet because this anguish reveals my freedom, my open possibilities, to try and escape it is bad faith, it's self-deception. Man's radical freedom removes the comfort of excuses from him. Trying to escape your freedom by assuming a conventional role. I'll just become the apprentice in my father's shop. By appealing to a moral norm. I won't be free, I'll just do what others have told me. Or trying to escape freedom by rationalizing that I couldn't help what I did. Sartre says all that's bad faith. To attempt being a detached thing in itself. To think that you were controlled by outside forces. But now we must question, mustn't we, whether Sartre has convincingly shown why this bad faith is in fact morally bad. Sartre would undoubtedly say bad faith is bad because it presents an obstacle to freedom. But of course that's just repeating the definition of bad faith and not explaining anything to us. Well, would he say that it's morally bad? Wouldn't he reject that kind of language as an existentialist? Well, the problem is that Sartre uses the word bad, and he uses it in a moralistic way. He deprecates people who engage in bad faith, who pretend they aren't existentially free, who say they're controlled by other forces. Consequently, he is making a moral judgment. But how can a moral judgment be made in the context of existentialist philosophy? We might be convinced that rationalizing, we might be convinced that failing to take responsibility for our deeds is in fact immoral. But following a conventional rule and appealing to rules, following a role in society, are hardly evil on the prima facie view of things. Sartre's exhortations against bad faith would appear to make us absurdly look for deep significance in every single action a man performs. Sartre at one point says the very way the waiter carries his tray has got to be a free decision. You see, if he just assumes the waiter's gait and the waiter's style, he is being controlled by some objective convention. And so it does appear that absurdly Sartre wants us to find significance in every single action we perform. And I think it strains the imagination to think that the way a man carries his briefcase is somehow morally significant. If nothing in life is trivial, as Sartre suggests, then we wonder if morality, in Sartre's sense, is at all significant. If not, then it would seem to be morality. It would not seem to be morality in any traditional sense. If the ethical advice Sartre has for us is merely avoid bad faith, which means choose as a sincerely free individual, aware of his freedom, then his ethic is entirely negative and doesn't really give us any positive direction or characterization of a moral viewpoint. Sartre leaves us without true direction and renders any free choice equally valuable with any other free choice. Equally valuable, because they can both be existentialist decisions. But now, shouldn't the choice of my breakfast cereal be placed somehow in a different category than my choice to assassinate the president? Are they really morally equal in value? Consequently, there can be no judging criteria, no scheme of values, which, as generally understood, is essential to making genuinely moral decisions in existentialism. Is not moral theory more than simply the general law that ethics must avoid general laws? It's an interesting reversal of the Kantian dictum, by the way. Kant said all morality must be generalized morality. Sartre says all morality must avoid general laws. Isn't that a general dictum for morality? Isn't he generalizing when he says avoid all generalization? Sartre's notion of freedom is simply that we must face up to our unpleasant situations by acting without guidance, setting an example of such caprice, even for torturing the innocent or committing genocide. Or we can evade our responsibility to do these things by bad faith. And I have to admit, in all honesty, as a human being, that those are bleak alternatives. And if that is what Sartre is getting at by freedom, then liberty is terror. As Sartre has set up his universe, man, I think, actually becomes deified and becomes given, ironically, the traditional attributes of the Godhead. Man creates himself, man elects himself, man structures the world, determines moral values, and creates truth, all things which the Christian God is said to do. And of course, the result is plain. Man turns out ruining himself in Sartre's literature, and Sartre admits it. The burden is too great, and the world is too horrible. And I think from a Christian standpoint, Sartre is just as honest at this point as we might wish. Sartre's difficulties reach far beyond, however, the nightmarish existence he's created for his characters and for us. I don't think that he even legitimately constructs the philosophical system which has given rise to that bad dream. And in my remaining moments, I'd like to give you some reason for that judgment. In the first place, Sartre's defense against the argument that man could not be absolutely free because of facticity fails him if you pursue it. Somebody says, Sartre, I'm not absolutely free. Look at all these facticity elements in my life. Now, Sartre tries to get around that in a clever way, as I've said, but I think that argument fails when you pursue it. It is mistaken to say that I choose my own obstacles. That is just false. For I do not choose the connection between my goal and that element of facticity which is incompatible with it. It may be true that I can choose my goal and not allow the wall to be an obstacle. I may choose to go out through the door rather than through the door, through the wall. That's right. But I do not choose the connection between that element of facticity which is incompatible with certain other goals. That connection, you see, has nothing to do with my choice. The incompatibility is simply given in the way that the world is. Now, to this, of course, Sartre replies that I freely give the world its form and character, and thus the inconsistency between facts and desires. But what can I say except that that's simply preposterous? I did not give this world its structure and form. I do not choose to prefer pleasure over pain. That's something I can't help. I do not choose the relationship between fire and the burning of my flesh. I do not choose the law of gravity which prevents my flying to California this afternoon. So I think we simply have to say this is a preposterous defense of man's radical freedom. Moreover, Sartre's reply turns out to be self-stultifying. If we really choose the truth, if we really choose the truth and define it as he says, then the whole noetic enterprise is somewhat self-defeating and senseless. You see, Sartre's view entails an ultimate subjectivity, so that if he were right, there would be no reason to think that he is right, because truth and knowledge simply become impossible. If truth is by my free choice, then the truth of his theory is by his free choice, and not because it matches up to an objective reality. Moreover, we simply have to note that Sartre, in all of his literature, never once grapples with the problems that have customarily clustered around the philosophical question of man's freedom. For instance, it has often been asked by philosophers, is any action significant or a responsible action in a chance universe? Sartre never once answers that question. And so the core of existentialism is curiously left without any support or defense, giving the distinct impression of arbitrariness and question-begging from the outset. Now, the responsibility and the anguish that Sartre says result from absolute freedom are in effect illusions on Sartre's basis, because as he expounds his position, it becomes impossible to make wrong choices. Sartre illegitimately hangs onto a concept of responsibility which is appropriate only to a world in which there are objective values that can be gained or rejected. I'm saying Sartre uses a concept that is appropriate only to a Christian worldview. If there is not value exterior to choice itself, as Sartre says, if there is no value exterior to choice itself, then the whole notion of responsibility is really no longer meaningful or appropriate. There are two things that immediately fault Sartre's idea of responsibility as attaching to the notion of choosing for others. One, in saying that, quote, nothing can be good for us without being good for all, Sartre then cancels the legitimate category of relative absolutes, that is, a class of actions that are either absolutely wrong or absolutely indifferent, depending upon the individual's own particular condition and situation. And secondly, since what all people are to learn by my example is that they simply must choose their actions freely, The distinct problem of conflicting desires and social disharmony has to be resolved in order to preserve an ethical system. And that's something Sartre conspicuously fails to do, even though his own viewpoint has pressed the dilemma of conflicting freedoms in upon us. That is, his whole attempt to make responsibility somewhat Kantian, I must choose as an example to others, dissolves upon analysis. In addition, Sartre's theory allows us to make the following odd assertion by inference. Doing your duty in obeying the law is irresponsible. I want you to think about that. The statement, doing your duty by obeying the law is irresponsible, that flows immediately from Sartre's philosophical views, in this assertion that I think is diametrically opposed to any ordinary intuitive understanding of responsibility. Indeed, one's responsibility is customarily conceived of in terms of obligation to law. Sheltering actions under rules is not irresponsible. It's rather the condition of social justice, rights, and freedom. Sartre's odd conception of responsibility would seem to require us to violate a law to be free, or never to act from a sense of duty in obeying the law. And yet, can you imagine a courtroom situation in which a man has been hauled in and is being tried for his dutifulness? In a Sartrean universe, we could try men for the irresponsibility of acting according to laws. Sartre's concept destroys genuine responsibility. It follows that there is no possibility of true guilt in a Sartrean system when an authentic decision is being made. And so there is no point to the notion of anguish. I'm not simply saying that his view of anguish is a nightmarish thing for us. I'm saying there's no point to it in his universe. Why should anybody be in anguish? Morality presupposes that there is something morally at stake when a decision is made. There's the possibility of being right or being wrong. But for Sartre, those distinctions disappear. And wrong action is analytically impossible. To say that such and such is a right action is simply to say that such and such is a free action. And if that's true, then you notice that negative moral judgments are impossible and positive moral judgments are superfluous. Because we never choose evil, by definition, what justification could there be for such a crass presupposition in this ethical philosophy? Since we never can choose evil, there's no longer any need for a corrective ethic. Now you might think, well, Sartre does distinguish between authentic choices and inauthentic choices. He says authentic choices are those which take freedom into account, and we should make authentic choices. Well, there are two things that I have to say to that. In the first place, it's true that the one genuine sin in Sartrean ethics is to make an inauthentic decision. But what does that show? That Sartre does have an objective law of ethics. He says there can be no objective law, but he says this universally. Nobody should make an inauthentic decision. On the other hand, why should we feel bad? Why should we feel anguish over neglecting our personal freedom? Why should we feel bad that we made an inauthentic decision? If it had been an authentic decision, it couldn't have been wrong. You can't go wrong if you freely choose. And since it wouldn't have made any difference what I did if I made it freely, how can it make any difference whether I chose not to make it freely or not? What I'm saying is if there's nothing at stake in the end, then there can never be any error along the way to that end, or even the failure to reach. Thus, Sartre's view that we must, that is to say, we ought to choose freely, begins to look on the one hand self-contradictory. We ought to choose freely means free of all laws, and so he has a law that says we must be without laws. And on the other hand, it turns out to be without content. It doesn't tell us anything at all. Furthermore, by making man's very nature the desire for freedom, how is it that Sartre can ever explain the need for the obligation to choose freely? Obviously, for Sartre, many people do not desire this freedom enough, and even resist recognizing that they have this freedom through self-deception. Now, how does he anthropologically explain this, if you will, sinful bent in men? That they are free, and yet they don't desire freedom enough. By basing man's obligation to desire freedom upon his nature to desire freedom as a being for itself, The fact that man refuses to desire freedom in bad faith negates his nature as a being for itself in Sartrean philosophy. But if his nature as a being for itself has been negated by his self-deception, hasn't he thus destroyed the basis for his obligation to be a man who chooses authentically? Hence, obligation is simply an impossible notion, no matter how you approach it. Obligation becomes impossible even from within the context of Sartrean's own ethics. Furthermore, Sartre is inconsistent with his doctrine of absolute freedom, for he does portray man, when all is said and done, as limited to a very great degree. He himself admits that his whole point is to describe the predicament of man in a world without God. Sartre says that man has no essence, yet he does speak of a universal human condition. He speaks of an ensemble of abstract conditions which constitute the human situation, and one wants to know, how is that not identical with a human essence? He does provide a sort of inventory, in fact, in being nothing, and thus of the significant attributes of the for itself, that is, of the attributes of man. He says, desire to be the in itself for itself, responsibility, anguish, all these things make up the universal human condition. And so I don't think it's true that Sartre has remained consistent with his doctrines and what they entail, because he has given an essence to man, despite his view that man has no essence. Since the morality that Sartre wants to establish is entailed by his doctrine of absolute freedom, and what I'm saying is his doctrine of absolute freedom entails his morality, which we have been criticizing in any number of ways over the last few minutes. Since the morality Sartre wants to establish is entailed by his doctrine of absolute freedom, and his doctrine of absolute freedom is entailed by his ontology, and his ontological views imply man's absolute freedom and imply his views of morality. Since all that's the case, the fact that his morality of radical freedom is unacceptable, you see, refutes his view of absolute freedom and ontology by modus tollens. Anything that implies that which is false is itself false. Okay, we've seen that his morality is shot through with philosophical problems. And if that's the case, by his view of absolute freedom implying this morality, it too must be false. And since it has been implied by his ontology, we have indirectly and by logical sequence refuted Sartre's ontology this afternoon too. I would add to this, and we don't have time to go over it, that Sartre's ontology is just shot through with philosophical equivocation. There are numerous senses in which he uses the word nothing, nothingness, being, not being, and Sartre does not seem to want to take the time to slow down to make all of these clear. So he ends up arguing premises with one sense of the word and concluding with a conclusion that uses the word in another sense altogether. And this is a common feature in his book. Just a concluding few words. Therefore, the Sartrean system is unacceptable and offers no compelling reason to be accepted. It is ontologically absurd, I'm using his language now, linguistically equivocating, logically inconsistent, and ethically self-vitiating. Sartre's religious approach to life is with the religion of man as his own Lord and Creator, and the results of that system are only the results of any consistent application of the principle of autonomous rationalism. Sartre is simply more honest than others in this age, more honest than most thinkers, in following out the line which extends back to what I think is the historical beginning of man's self-sufficient rationalism, and that at the beginning, where the Bible tells us the satanic temptation is, you shall be as gods, determining good and evil. Sartre, I think, is quite familiar with that satanic promise, for he defines man in being and nothingness on page 566 as, quote, the being who tries to become God. Such is the graveyard, then, of autonomous ethics. When man turns away from the law of God and the worldview that is given to us in God's Word in favor of a humanistic self-law, the inevitable result, it would appear to this philosopher, is the loss of any hope for ethics and eventually the spiritual death of man and his culture. Sartre has failed to answer the crucial questions of normative ethics, meta-ethics, and ontology. He has failed through the assumption of a non-biblical anthropology wherein man is not the creature of an authoritative and sovereign Lord Creator who has placed his indelible image in man and who has perspicuously revealed himself to each man in every facet of man's environment. Sartre is culpable for trying to develop his own ethic, if Christianity is right, for God's image and revelation are said to be inescapable. Sartre knows that he is a creature accountable to God, and God's law condemns the law of Sartre. Sartre has failed adequately to define the good. He has failed to supply any genuine authority for his ethic, to provide genuine and positive moral direction and correction. He has failed to suggest a compelling motivation for ethical living. He has failed to set forth a final goal, as well as the power to actualize the goal. And so for all of its ethical flavor, Sartre's writings are simply the ethic of non-ethic. And this fact should prevent Sartre from being wise in his own conceits. But lest we should become like unto him in such foolishness, then I would at least suggest at the end of this lecture that there is a word from God in the scriptures that provides a genuine ethic for man. There good can be defined. There God reveals what godlike behavior on the level of the creation is, supplying direction and correction for life. And the fact that the Lord has delivered a moral law can give ethics a genuine authority. Man will be held accountable for his obedience or his disobedience to this law. Man is given a motivation to keep this law, either out of faith in God and reverence for his person, or out of fear of the coming judgment, if need be. And in the former case, the motive of morality corresponds with the motive which all men ought to have, love to God and their neighbor. And the enabling power of obedience is found, according to the biblical viewpoint, in the sanctifying work of the Holy Spirit in believers, as well as in common grace in unbelievers. There is a goal for godly ethics given in the glory to be brought to God's name and the advance of Christ's kingdom of righteousness extended in the earth, thereby bringing blessings and social relations. Now, I'm not arguing, of course, that all this is true on anybody's say-so, least of all mine. I'm simply saying that we should at least recognize the choice and the character of the choice that's before us. The choice is between God's law and Sartrean ethics. And it's the choice that philosophically, as well as personally and culturally, is the same that Moses gave to the children of Israel when he said, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that I've set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. Therefore choose life that you may live, you and your seed. And that in Deuteronomy, the 30th chapter. Thank you.